Four other beautiful gestures. One is like this, with the left arm outside. This has a name, by the by. It's called, in some rites, the sign of the Good Shepherd. And it symbolizes divine love. With the left arm, heart side up. This divine power, with the right arm outside. And in all of these ways, in various rites and gestures and postures and asanas, as they are called, all have a meaning. Most pictures of yogis in meditation show them in the lotus or the lion postures, cross-legged as usual, and with the thumb and forefingers joined. And they all yogis practically meditate like this. And if you ask them why, they will say, to preserve the magnetic forces and currents in the body. Seems a little strange to us, but that's what they do. Probably these are all mental as well as physical. When you close your hands in meditation, you are, as it were, a complete magnetic hose. And there's no escape of your personal forces. Oh, yes. Sometimes in meditation, one has the impression of the eyeballs wanting to turn upwards. This reminds me of pictures of yogis in the lotus posture, with the eyeballs apparently turned upwards. Is this a correct phenomenon? If so, what does it mean? Yes, it is a correct phenomenon. In certain forms of pranayama, that means meditation together with breath control, the lotus position is adopted, by the by again, with the finger and thumb joined, and the eyes turned upwards. And the successful yogi can and does turn them up so highly inside the orbit that you can't see the pupil. You can only see the lower white. If they open their eyes, you don't see the pupil. And when they're instructing you, they turn their eyes right up so the pupils are out of sight. The meanings would seem to be fairly clear, indicating perhaps that consciousness is deliberately turned inwards and upwards and away from the light and phenomena of the physical world. Kind of physical preparation for yoga, you see. Withdraw completely. There are probably other reasons to do with the direction upwards into the head of certain nervous, magnetic, and other energies in the body. For example, kundalini. When the eyeballs are turned upwards in meditation, it's a suggestion, perhaps an actual procedure of drawing all the forces in the body upwards into the head, highly to sensitize it and make the brain mind receptive to the higher consciousness. Remember that some of these mudras, postures, are very, very ancient indeed. They come back down to us from the remotest time. They may not have a great deal of significance dynamically today, but they are symbolic. And anything which assists the yogi, the devotee, to turn the mind inwards and hold it there is regarded as helpful. So all of these various postures. Other yogis say that none of them are necessary. For instance, Sri Ramana Maharshi of Tiruvannamalai, he says, any comfortable position is an asana. Meaning what? Well, your body's relaxed. That's all. You remember when we studied all these things together a few Sundays ago? The great essential is that the body should be relaxed. Another essential is, of course, that the whole motive should be selfless. No idea of gaining power for yourself, prestige, position, any kind of return whatever would completely block the whole procedure. Selflessness, evidently, is very important. Yes, I suppose, just occurred to me a reason for that. I suppose if it's very difficult to forget yourself and the activities of your mind, and these are all ways of helping us to do so, to reverse the normal procedure and practice of life. We have to think of ourselves. We have to earn our livings and prepare for our loved ones. We have to live in the world of men, you see. But when you turn to the spiritual life, you seem to have to reverse the whole procedure, sacrifice yourself, and become one with the whole. The mind is part of the difficulty in this, you know. However, we'll talk about this on Sunday morning, shall we? So perhaps this turning up of the eyes refers to the drawing up of Kundalini from the center of the earth, through the feet and legs, up the spinal cord, into the head. Now, more questions. Could you explain why all the great masters of the wisdom, about whom it has been permitted us to have some details, are all men? Well, I'm glad the questioner has put, about whom it has been permitted us to have some details, because there is knowledge about female adepts. Female adepts almost certainly exist, but may not have been willing to declare themselves to the outer world. But there are hints as we read occult literature. For example, Subha Rao, in his very valuable book, Esoteric Writings, tells that the mother of the body of the avatara, Parasurama, was a very high adept. The mother of the body of the avatar. An avatar is a descent, the meaning of the word, of an aspect of the solar logos into a prepared, purified, and initiated human vehicle. Then that's an avatar. Such as happened to Jesus at baptism, so it is said. One of these avatars, the seventh, was Parasurama, which means Rama of the axe. His mother was a great adept who had made original discoveries in science. Subha Rao, Esoteric Writings, valuable book. Subha Rao, R-O-W. S-U-B-B-A-R-O-W. Thank you, dear. There are hints, however, in occult literature that the masculine body is more suitable for the handling of the forces involved in the attainment of adeptship. Then there is the Chinese, great Chinese adept called Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy and compassion. She was a girl born to a family, and very early in life she felt called to the spiritual life, wished to leave home and go into a convent, but her family forbade her withdrawal. So she stole away in the night went to a convent in the East, in China, I think, and engaged in profound meditation and quickly developed adeptic powers and stature. And she has now become the great representative in the East of the World Mother idea. Kuan Yin, in Vietnam, I think, Nicola, it's Quan Am, isn't it? Quan Am. But it's the same principle, isn't it? Say thank you. And in Japan, yes, thank you. So there is a female adept, worshipped. Profoundly reverenced in the East. Then there is the tradition of concerning the Mother of Jesus, who is referred to sometimes as the Blessed Lady Mary. There may be, I think there is, a mystical meaning to the pronouncement of her assumption and coronation. The coronation of Our Lady, when she became Queen of the Angels. Maybe a mere dogma, but it probably has behind it some occult idea that she attained. At any rate, she is now venerated by millions upon millions who have seen her and noted that she possessed her adeptic powers of great efficacy. C.W. Leadbeater tells us that Pallas Athene was an adept in female form. Read his book, The World Mother in Symbol and in Fact, as symbol and as fact. Does the path of initiation supersede the path of discipleship at and after the first initiation? Well, this brings us to our subject for this week and probably afterwards, when we will consider the whole wonderful teaching of the ancient wisdom concerning the adepts, adeptship, the adepts, and the masters of the wisdom. But I could answer in advance by saying that not quite supersede. Does the path of initiation supersede the path of discipleship? At and after the first initiation, no. Not as far as I know. I'd rather say that the initiations follow the path of discipleship, but that the preceding steps of probation, acceptance, and sonship all still have their efficacy, and the initiate is still a disciple of his master. And so the ego and its successive personalities remain as disciples of the master right up to adeptship, after which the relationship is no longer necessary as a form of assistance, the goal having been won. There is evidence, however, that a very close relationship continues to maintain after adeptship. There is another tradition, however, and all this is mere traditional occultism, you know. It is also said that an initiate of the fourth degree, an arahat, enters into relationship with an adept of a still higher attainment than his master. Namely, at the seventh initiation, a great being called the Mahachoha. And at arhatship, the arhat ego also becomes the disciple of our Lord, the Mahajan. Now, never mind about these strange Sanskrit words. I'm going into it all carefully with you on Saturday and Monday. But I must say these things in order to try and help and answer our questioner. This added discipleship of a still greater being in the adept hierarchy may also be planned to help the Arhat through the final stages of attainment of adeptship. You must remember that all of this about which these questions are asked pertains to the hastening of evolution. The attainment of adeptship far ahead of the race. Normally the attainment would be first initiation at the head of the end of this round, this world period, and second and third according to the rounds, and adeptship much further on. But it is possible to force the pace, to take the kingdom of heaven by storm, and become a disciple of an adept who helps you to this attainment. And these questions apply to all this. I'll be going more closely into things. Now Sandra is going to talk to us, explaining and introducing her contribution for this evening, which is called The Occult Tradition, and is largely illustrated, and I find really follows on what we've been talking about. For all this hastening of evolution belongs to the occult tradition. Yes. Here is Sandra.
I am going to give 15 minutes of introduction, then we break, and then my slides will follow afterwards. Behind the objective and unreal world, there exists the world of the real, wherein it is said, the motive of compassionate service, of ministration, activates all spiritual beings. This might be termed the occult tradition of the divine principle of ministration, by the highest to the lowest, by the greater to the lesser, and by the spiritual seniors to the spiritual juniors. The occult tradition of occult and spiritual ministration, we understand, commenced with the cosmic logos, so far as could be known, and it continues in its operation through hierarchical descent, down through the seven mighty spirits before the throne, on down through the manus of schemes, chains, rounds, and planets, down to the great Lord of the world on this our earth globe, and still on down through him to the members of the great white brotherhood of initiated adepts, and on through their pupils, who are their human representatives in the so-called outer world, passing on to all human beings who are selflessly serving mankind and all that suffers. We learn from HPB that the origin of the occult tradition is contained in a divine revelation by exalted superhuman beings at the beginning of human evolution upon Earth. HPB stated in her magazine Lucifer, October 1889, these words, "What do I believe in?" She answers, "One, the unbroken oral teachings revealed by living divine men during the infancy of mankind to the elect among men. Two, that it has reached us unaltered. And three, that the masters are thoroughly versed in the science based on such uninterrupted teaching." The occult tradition of ministration by these lofty spiritual seniors includes the establishment upon earth of the occult hierarchy of initiated adepts and their pupils, their institution of the lesser and the greater mysteries of initiation, and the introduction of the sacred language of allegory, myth, and symbol. Under the veil of the sacred language, the occult tradition has been concealed throughout untold ages within the secrets, mysteries, and processes of initiation. It has in consequence been thus preserved from abuse by the profane, and yet at the same time it has been revealed to the initiates and committed aspirants to spiritual knowledge and self-illumination. HPB wonderfully records in the Secret Doctrine the beginning of the occult tradition upon earth by the descent from on high to our earth of the great Lord of the world, the spiritual ruler of the planet, and his helpers. Thus was formed the first nucleus for the great white brotherhood of Earth's adepts. In the Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, Stanza 6, pages 227 to 229 inclusive, alluding to the Lord of the world, the account reads, calling him the ever-living human banyan tree, a wondrous being called the One Initiator, who descended from a high region, they say, in the early part of the Third Age, before the separation of the sexes in the Third Race. Still quoting, and after him came a group of semi-divine and semi-human beings, sons of will and yoga. They were set apart to form the nursery for future human adepts on this earth and during the present cycle. End of the quotation. The Lord of the world is also known in Hinduism as the Sanat Kumara, meaning the eternal virgin youth, who is said in the occult tradition to appear as a gloriously beautiful youth of 16 summers. Furthermore, he is known as the One Initiator because no human being can be initiated into the greater mysteries without his assent. This is all a great mystery. Therefore, untold ages ago was instituted by the inner government of the world, under their spiritual king, the process of deliberate, adept-aided, spiritual quickening of the evolution of the human monads and egos, which we term the occult tradition. The greater mysteries of the occult tradition included the path of discipleship of a spiritual teacher who leads the pupil in ethics, morality, meditation, and yoga on through the probationary stages of the path of holiness, first into the lesser mysteries of symbol, character development, and purification, and then into the greater mysteries of direct knowing of truth, unveiled, of self-regeneration, of self-unfoldment and of self-illumination. This schooling of awakened egos has continued on our planet, we are told, to this day. It doubtless will continue, so long as humanity needs it, until all the human monad egos on this earth, no doubt, have attained to the level of the fifth initiation, that of the Asika Adept, which takes mankind out of the human into the superhuman level. The Lord of the world, the one initiator, the Sanat Kumara, has his center at Shambhala, as it is called in the secret doctrine, Shambhala, somewhere in the vast Gobi Desert. And at the time of his descent to Earth, millions of years ago, the Gobi Desert was then the Gobi Sea. And Shambhala was a beautiful white island in the midst of the Gobi Sea. From sacred Shambhala, the spiritual heart and head of our planet, the wonderful ruler of the hierarchy presides over the ever-concealed adept ministration of the occult tradition to all sincere, dedicated, and aspiring human beings. And from this center of Earth's spiritual sovereignty came forth the divine founders of all the world religions, all the historical saviors of mankind, the great sages of antiquity, the spiritually illumined prophets, saints, teachers, and hierophants of the mystery schools. And in our era, two of these great elder brothers of humanity conceived of the Theosophical Society with the aid of a few of their brother adepts and through their human agents, H.P. Blavatsky and H.S. Alcott. These two masters of the wisdom inspired and assisted at the foundation and establishment of the Theosophical Society in 1875. The society itself, therefore, is a vehicle for the unseen forces of spiritual light and dynamism, working through basic archetypal ideas upon the mind of humanity. Thus, the Theosophical Society is a vehicle or a medium for a wonderful occult and spiritual form of service, of ministration to the whole world. Jeffrey has most kindly made me slides of pictures I have collected to illustrate my story of the occult tradition. These slides are not actual. They are symbolic only and are attempts to portray the unportrayable. I need not add that he has checked with me all my efforts at interpretation of symbols and has supplied necessary data where I could not supply it. And now I will close with reading another excerpt to describe the Lord of the World from the Secret Doctrine, whose pages I have quoted to you previously. As objective man, he is the mysterious personage about whom legends are rife in the East. It is he who changes form and yet remains ever the same. And it is he again who holds spiritual sway over the initiated adepts throughout the whole world. He is, as said, the nameless one who has so many names and yet whose names and whose very nature are unknown. He is the great initiator called the Great Sacrifice. For sitting at the threshold of light, He looks into it from within the circle of darkness, nor will he quit his post till the last day of this life cycle, because he would fain show the way to that region of light and freedom to every prisoner who has succeeded in liberating himself from the bonds of flesh and illusion. Because, in short, he has sacrificed himself for the sake of mankind.